the way, let me define the word nature for you. Nature comes from the Latin word for birth. Something's seed. If you plant a mustard seed, you always get a mustard bush. It grows, and then it decays. How do you know when it stops growing and starts decaying? Because every living thing decays after it grows. You could say the end of the human being is the same as the end of the oak tree. They both rot into the ground. But we don't say that. There's some moment at which they become most fully themselves. They become good ones of their kind. That's when you see an oak tree in its prime, or a man or woman in his prime. Then you think of them, oh yeah, very good, right? So that's what it is. It means being and acting as the kind of thing you are. And you can see and observe that in things all the time. That's what C.S. Lewis means. Hello, my name is Larry Arn. I teach here at Hillsdale College. This is an online course on the very great C.S. Lewis, an Oxford professor, later a Cambridge professor. There's several of us teaching it. I'm teaching the lectures on one of his most important and distressing books called The Abolition of Man. Think of that, to abolish man. And you discover in this lecture, in this book by C.S. Lewis, that it is man that may abolish man. He makes an argument about that. Last time I talked mostly about the first of three chapters. That's entitled Men Without Chest. The second chapter is called The Way, in the sense of the way to go, the natural law, first principles, the Tao, he says, after the Chinese word for the way of the gentleman, perhaps. And the final chapter is called The Abolition of Man. I'm going to talk about those last two, probably mostly about the second one today. To summarize where we got to, I'll tell you an anecdote. I had some visitors on Sunday, and an old friend of mine, very bright man, very important man, a good man, and his really brilliant daughter. And she goes to a different college, and she's a very faithful young woman, and she's beautiful, and I so regret that she didn't come to our college. And we got to talking, and we had the kind of conversation that one can have with the young all he wants in this day and age. I like to quiz students about what is the good, another synonym for what C.S. Lewis means by the way. And she's very upbeat, and she allowed that the good is what each person thinks it is. And if they think hard about it and adopt it, what they think, and do it sincerely, then they will have the good and they will be good, she said. And I said, what I always say in those circumstances, what if they want to do something bad and think that's good? Well, it's up to them, she said. So then, of course, I brought out Adolf Hitler, who's handy in these conversations, one of the worst criminals in human history. And she said, yeah, well, he believed in what he was doing, she said, so with a kind of grudging respect. And I said, let me repeat for you what he did. Because, you know, it's not hard to summarize. He caused several million people to be arrested at gunpoint. He caused them to be loaded onto cattle cars, except when they were lined up and shot. They were trooped across Europe in cattle cars, sometimes at the expense of the moving of war material in the greatest war in human history. Many of them died on the journey of starvation or exposure. And then when they got out, they were often, later in the war, released into death camps, where they were sorted into two groups, the ones who would be worked until they were nearly dead for a time, and then the ones who would go immediately where they would all end up, which was in a gas chamber and then a crematorium, where their body parts were, before they were burned up, were mined for whatever might be of value in them. That's the thing that Hitler apparently thought was okay. Do you think that's okay? And so now she's shaking a little bit, you know, because that's a pretty bad thing, about as bad a thing as there ever was. And her response to that was, no, she guessed she didn't. And I said, good, because now we need some standard outside our opinions to condemn this thing, because it surely was the opinion of Adolf Hitler and his chief henchmen that this was a really good thing to do. In fact, one of the greatest things ever to be done is what they thought and argued. So chapter one of this book is about that phenomenon. These people who write this grammar book teach that it's silly or it's a confusion to call a waterfall sublime, because really what you think of the waterfall is just because of some emotion inside yourself, which means there's no contact with the outside world. That's chapter one. Lewis begins chapter two by repeating this point in this way. He says, you know, to show that this opinion that is latent in this textbook for high school boys and girls leads necessarily to death, to show that doesn't refute it. It could be true. It could be that the thing is true, that if we accept it, we die. Then he quotes from the Iliad, speech by Menelaus, one of the key Greeks in the Iliad. And Menelaus says, if you are to destroy us, then at least do it in the shining light. That's roughly how the Greek translates. And C.S. Lewis said that was sort of the spirit, right? If we find out that this thing is true, even if it leads to our extinction, we should believe it. Better to be true than false, he says. But wait, he says, it's not as bad as that. He says, because although these guys argue that this thing is true, that is, that there's no value outside your own thinking, they don't actually act like that. So maybe they don't really believe it, or maybe they're in a contradiction, and that means we wouldn't have to follow them because a thing that's contradictory can't be true. He says, they've written this book. And this book is intended to teach the young, that is to say, to change what the young are like. So this is chapter two, right? And he says, but that means they must be preferring for the young to be one way as opposed to another way. On what ground is that preference? Because, you know, this debunking, he calls it, that goes on about the waterfall, they don't do it about their own claims. Their own claims are, you have to get rid of all traditional or supposed or sham sentiment, and you must just realize the basis of everything. And they don't say that this must, remember this word must, you must do this thing. Why must you do this thing? Because apparently this thing is better. But they don't say, of course, my argument that my way of doing it is better, it's just my own emotion. They actually claim it really is better. That's why they wrote the book. And Lewis says, so let's think about that for a little bit. And he writes this, and this is an important thing, because it ties into something we can observe in our day all the time. It's amazing how many people argue that values are relative to the person. And it's amazing how many of those people are always giving one orders about what one must think. You'd think they'd stop that. But no, the one thing you're not to think is that values have any real meaning. And if you do understand that that's true, then you'll end up thinking like me. And Lewis writes of these two guys who wrote this grammar book. He says, in actual fact, Gaius and Titius will be found to hold with complete uncritical dogmatism the whole system of values which happened to be in vogue among moderately educated young men of the professional classes during the period between the two world wars. So in other words, they think what everybody who's an intellectual thinks. They all think it. They all think it the same. It's a sort of preview of the elevation of diversity in the university today. Diversity is an interesting word. It means, in the Latin, it derives from the sense of vice versa, you know, it means turning. Versity means turning. So diversity means things turning around more than one thing. University actually means things turning around just one thing. So the purpose of a university could not really be diversity, but we claim it is this day and age. And so that's what's going on today, isn't it? That people say that there's no objective basis for the things that people have always called right and wrong, and yet you have to organize the society the way I say. That's what Lewis says these guys are doing. And so he says, let's put it to the test in this chapter. He says, let's pick death, because death, he uses the Latin, is a crucial experiment. What would you die for? To have this kind of society which is not troubled with the old traditional taboos and superstitions, but liberated from them to know that it's only what we think that is the measure of everything. Would you die for that society? Would they ask you to die for that society? Would they command soldiers to die and to kill for that society? That's the question he asked. And if they did ask them to do that, in the name of what would they ask them? Because, you know, it wouldn't be to the advantage of the soldiers in any personal or narrow inward emotional sense to die, because as Aristotle writes about death, it's a limit. Far as we know, far as we can see, that's it. So that's a big commitment. So you can't really get them to do it because you can't pay them to do it. So why would they do it? On what ground would they do it? And Lewis says in this chapter that there are two main ones that go around among people who hold these views. I'll remind you what he says these views are. They have, with complete uncritical dogmatism, the whole system of values which happened to be in vogue among moderately educated young men of the professional classes during the period between the two wars, he says. Would you die for that? And he says, well, you would do it because we all have a duty to preserve the species for posterity. And Lewis says, why do we have that? Is it just something we think, or is it something objective? Are you now proposing that that's an objective thing? If we don't recognize it, we're in the wrong, whatever our inward emotional state. What is the ground of that? Are you appealing back to this old traditional thing? Because it is, sure enough, a claim in all of the great religions and all of the great moral codes. Lewis argues throughout. You can tell who are the people that I admire because I confuse their names. Throughout this book, and at the end in a wonderful appendix which you should read, Lewis argues that these things are common in every culture, these basic old truths that command that we behave well toward other people. And he says, are you going to go borrow from that? You've just destroyed all that. You've just said all that superstition. You call that stuff forward and you ask it to prove. Like, for example, the Christian precept, which if you'll look in the appendix to the Abolition of Man, you'll see that this Christian precept in different forms is in all kinds of cultures, ancient and modern, East and West, the Christian precept, do as you would be done by. Which goes a little farther than don't do to somebody what you wouldn't want done to you. It's more positive, right? Treat them the way you would want to be treated. There's more to that. It's not just avoiding something, it's doing something positive. And he says you could ask the question, why? But if you don't teach the young that things like that are true, they'll never understand that they're true. That's a kind of puzzling argument, isn't it? Because what Lewis is saying is all the basic old truths that your mom and dad used to say, he's saying if they're not taught to you when you're young, you'll have great trouble later learning the truth of them. Which means you have to be kind of indoctrinated in some way, doesn't it? And I will tell you, I've thought about that because this point is in Aristotle, in the first book of Nicomachean Ethics, for example. And I've thought about that for years, and I have an explanation from my own life. Come to find out, one of my favorite things my mom and dad to say was, we didn't have a lot to give our kids, but at least we taught them right from wrong. And I heard that 1,000 times, and it was a familiar in my house. And I remember the time came when I was getting fancy about my education, and I began to wonder, when, in fact, did they ever do that? Like, I can't remember the time when my father sat me down and said, son, I've always said that I was going to teach you the difference between right and wrong, and now we're going to have a conversation about it. Here's what it is. I can't remember him ever saying that. And I used to puzzle about that, and indeed, I even talked to him about that a few times after I got older and was in college and after college. I was a very troublesome young man for a while in college because I met people like this Gaius and Titius, and I began to think the way they think. Then I met somebody like C.S. Lewis, and I stopped thinking the way they think. But then later, as I studied Aristotle and C.S. Lewis, I began to see what the truth of the matter was, and that is, by saying that, they were teaching me the difference between right and wrong. I grew up thinking the exact opposite of the teaching of Gaius and Titius. Just like with Gaius and Titius, what I was taught was just taught as an assumption without an argument behind it, because I was too young for the argument. Let's say you're gonna teach a young person how to prove something. You can't begin by saying, I'm going to prove to you what proving means. Because, of course, they don't know what it is. So the first step is you just have to tell them what it is. And mind you, they'll get plenty of time in their lives to figure out whether you're right about it or not. But you start them somewhere. And in my case, I was not taught growing up by my parents. I was not taught, if you see something, son, and you really love it, and you're attached to it, I want you to remember that that's just an opinion of yours, and it can't be that that thing is really valuable. I was told the opposite of that. I was told right and wrong are of fundamental importance. And, you know, now I remember, but it took me years to put this together, that when I wanted something, and of course, I was a kid, I always wanted something. And my dad didn't have very much money. And also, and that was a constraint, but there was another one. Well, son, you shouldn't have that. Wouldn't be right, right? So come to find out, I grew up thinking those were extremely important categories, just exactly the way C.S. Lewis says here. And then what my dad taught me is that the categories, right and wrong, are very important, and they mean something. They don't just mean what I think they mean or he thinks they mean. And one needed to know what they were and act according to that knowledge. That's what he taught me. He didn't tell me what right and wrong were exactly, except in specific instances, which is the prime way you know them. And so I got to thinking about that a lot. And now, you know, I'm all grown up and I teach Aristotle and C.S. Lewis, as I said. And I know how they explain that. And it's beautiful the way they explain it. And it makes a lot of sense, and it might help you understand this book. Because just take any ordinary object, right? What's that? That's a water bottle. And there's lots of water bottles. There's all kinds of them. I have some stainless steel ones that I'm partial to. And there's a lot of water bottles like this, and there's a lot of other kinds. And yet we call them all water bottles, even though they differ. And if this were the water bottle, there would only be one of them, right? Because every other one differs in some respect to this one, if nothing else, just because it's not in this blot right now. So how do you know? You never really see. You can never see the water bottle. And yet you always recognize them and everything else you see, you know, spectacles, whatever. Whenever, you know, necktie, right, all of that. You always recognize all of that when you see it, and you're never really trained to do it. You just pick it up. This is actually the prime faculty of human reason, we find out in Aristotle, the use of common nouns. And I'll tell you an interesting thing about that. If you took this water bottle and cut the bottom out of it anymore, right, cut the bottom out of it right there, it wouldn't work. It'd be broken. It would no longer be a good water bottle. And water bottles like this are especially good to make this point because they easily convert into something else. If you did cut the bottom off of it, and then you took the top off, don't you have a funnel? You can use it. I have. We live in Michigan. Sometimes I get one of these things when I can't find a funnel, and I fill my snowblower up with gas in it. We need that here, right? So it's not anymore a good water bottle, but if you take the bottom off and turn it upside down, it isn't even a water bottle. And that teaches what? Aristotle says the good and being are convertible terms. So you start out with these precepts, like from my dad, and if you think about it hard enough, you start seeing that good means being a good one of each thing. And if there's such a thing as a good water bottle, perhaps there's such a thing as a good human being. And perhaps that's an objective thing that lets you identify the human being when you see it. And why, for example, I mentioned Hitler earlier. Watch that movie Downfall, where at the end of that, he actually acts like some kind of a decaying animal. He shakes and quakes and rages. He's hardly a man anymore. He's becoming a monster. Now, you see what that is? That means that for me to figure all that out, and I have figured it out. And how did I figure it out? I figured it out by reading books, hard books, for a long time, many, many years. And then especially by the special joy of teaching those books to young people. And imagine some of you people are old people. Young and old alike are human if they've got good minds and they'll use them. And when you teach, it's amazing how much you learn. But it started with somebody telling me that those categories were important. Whereas, remember I started with that young woman. Probably a lot of somebodies have told that young woman that she's got the problem of morality all figured out. The problem of good, the problem of right and wrong. What matters is that you do what you believe. And if you do, you're good. And it hadn't really occurred to her. A lot of people do a bunch of evil stuff. And a lot of those people believe in it. And you know what's wrong with Hitler? You know, because I said you could ruin this water bottle. It wouldn't be a good one anymore until you turn it into a funnel. It's an abuse of the water bottle. It wrecks its function if you cut the bottom off of it or poke holes in the side. What did Hitler do wrong? In fact, those people that he loaded onto those cattle cars were not cattle. They were people. Writing about the Declaration of Independence a few days before he died. Died on the 4th of July, did Thomas Jefferson. What does it mean, he was asked. Means that some are not born with saddles on their backs. Some men are not born with saddles on their backs and others booted and spurred to ride them by the grace of God. Men are not horses, and they're not to be treated that way. And everything in nature, in fact, every artifact, which means everything we make, we recognize what it is because of the good that it serves, and that gives it its being. That's what Lewis is arguing, and he's arguing against the way of arguing that deprives us of the knowledge of that. Now, toward the end of this chapter, he makes a passage that I think is really brilliant. And I'll read it to you. It's worth dwelling on. There never has been, he says, and never will be, a radically new judgment of value in the history of the world. What purport to be new systems, or as they now call them, ideologies, That's a favorite word of mine because Winston Churchill said in 1936, have we not, he was talking about the Nazis and the communists, have we not an ideology if we must use that ugly word of our own? That's what Lewis is calling it there, indirectly, an ugly word. What purports to be new systems of value or ideologies all consist of fragments from the Tao itself, arbitrarily wrenched from their context in the whole and then swollen to madness in their isolation, yet still owing to the Tao and to it alone such validity as they possess. If justice is a superstition, then so is my duty to my country or my race. The rebellion of new ideologies against the Tao is a rebellion of the branches against the tree. You can't prove these things or disprove them until you establish the categories in the mind of which they are part. And the education of the young starts with that. And then, of course, Lewis writes in this chapter, he says, understand the meaning of what he writes. So I like Aristotle a lot, and I like C.S. Lewis a lot, and I have found them intensely instructive. But Lewis's claim is that all of these arguments by C.S. Lewis and all of the arguments that I brought into play by Aristotle, which have some notice in the works of Lewis too, they don't invent anything. The way, the Tao, the natural law, the first principles, they existed a long time before Aristotle and C.S. Lewis existed. And he says that what we can do, we who study the Tao and try to gain a sophisticated knowledge of it. I used to say to my dad after we had, because we had a spell where we were arguing some about the way of things, about nature and life and right and wrong and politics too. Didn't last very long. I was lucky about meeting a good teacher soon. But after all that was over, I would say to him, well, Dad, I spent a long time learning complicated reasons why you were right. And he just loved that, see. But that, I think, is the phenomenon. That is to say, people who make a serious study, as you are making of this right now, what are you going to achieve? You're going to make the Tao live more richly. You might embellish it. You might even improve it. But Lewis's point is, you can only do that from within the Tao. And so the way, that's what this chapter is about, the way is all important because it leads us to the good, which means the recognition even of what that is. Thank you very much.